Welcome to Songcraft. I'm Paul Duncan.
And I'm Scott B. Bomar. You're listening to After All by our guest, Dar Williams.
Go ahead, push your luck, find out how much love the world can hold. Once upon a time I had control and reigned my
Author, educator, and celebrated singer-songwriter Dar Williams was always in the right place at the right time for the success she's had over a career that has spanned 30 years. She emerged from the vibrant mid-90s Boston scene, inspired by the eclectic influences of alt-rockers, Berkeley jazz musicians, slam poets, and folk artists, including Patti Griffin, Melissa Ferrick, Throwing Muses, Vance Gilbert, and Jonathan Brook. After a year of touring nonstop with her first album, The Honesty Room, in 1994, Dar was invited by Joan Baez to tour in Europe and the United States. She has now recorded more than a dozen studio albums and recently released the book How to Write a Song That Matters, which was born from the songwriting retreats she's been conducting since 2013.
Part 1.
Well, Paul, we've been in season 2 of Songcraft now for, this is our fourth episode back.
Yeah.
And we have not mentioned one of our dear friends who definitely is part of the Songcraft team. And that's our friend Justin and the fine folks at Pearl Snap Studios, which you can find at pearlsnapstudios.com. And if people have been listening to Songcraft for any amount of time, you have heard us talk about Pearl Snap and what they can do for you. But maybe you're new, maybe you've just joined us for season 2 and you don't know the old episodes. Paul, tell them what Pearl Snap can do.
Here's what happens. You send in a song to Pearl Snap Studios and maybe you're not quite finished with the production. Maybe you don't think that your vocal sounds great. Maybe you don't think that it's ready to be pitched or even to go, directly to the radio, maybe?
Yeah, maybe you're making a record.
But you send it over to Justin and his team of crack producers, and they turn this thing around. They turn it into a recording that you can be proud of. You're already proud of the song. Don't you want to be proud of the recording, too?
Absolutely. And maybe you've written a great song, and let's be honest, your voice might be terrible. and maybe your guitar playing is rudimentary at best, but you go, man, I really like this song. Maybe you wrote a song for your significant other, and you want to give it to them as a gift, but you think, I'm not really an artist, but this is a heartfelt expression. You can send that to Justin and his team, and they will make a fantastic professional recording. Whether you are an advanced songwriter who needs some good demos, whether you are just starting out and this is your first demo ever, even if you're making a record, whatever your situation, go to pearlsnapstudios.com. Check out the wide array of things that they can do for you. They have multiple tiers depending on what you need done. And make sure that you tell them Songcraft sent you, because if you do, you're going to get a discount.
Well, Scott, this is, I think, the first time we've started a part one, and I have known without a shadow of a doubt that it's going to be outdated in a few months, that this conversation is going to not age well.
Okay.
Because we're going to have a conversation about AI, artificial intelligence, and the only thing I know about it is that it's going to get better, it's going to get bigger, it's going to become more ubiquitous in a matter of months. So whatever we say right now, I'm already not standing behind.
All right. By the time we record this to the time we launch it,
totally,
which will be a few hours.
Yes. Everything will have
changed. Will have changed.
Yeah.
And we will be all enslaved by the computers. The computers the robots are going to get us.
God, we're recording this on a computer. Is that short-sighted?
Yeah. It knows everything.
Yes,
it knows what we're talking about. A friend of ours, Caroline Rigsby, who we both know, lives in Nashville. She sent me an article last week from the Nashville Business Journal, I believe it's called. I'm sure you're a subscriber.
Huge subscriber to all business
all
journals.
Business. I'm a big business guy.
Yeah,
big business journal person. I think we both have that in common. But no, she sent us this article. And it's basically an article about Nashville being such a songwriting town and what threat AI is presenting to the songwriting community. Now, maybe some of the folks who are listening to this maybe don't even know what we're exactly talking about. So you, as a full-time professional songwriter, this is something that folks are definitely talking about in that community. Just give a quick synopsis of what what AI and these chatbots, what this even is.
Well, I'll say this. Over the last few months, pretty much everyone that knows me who is not a full-time songwriter has sent me an article about AI and the threat it poses to my life and my livelihood. So thanks, everyone. you know, we're to the point now where these text generator models have become sophisticated enough that you can just ask this thing, like a ChatGPT is one of the, you know, the new applications of this, where you can say, write me a song, and it will spit out a lyric in a matter of seconds.
Right.
Now, you know, you can do these things. There are plenty of things that have already been going on where you can generate chord progressions, you can generate rhythms. Obviously, drum machines have been a part of songwriting for a long time and music production. But now we're getting to the point where you really feel like you could, you know, ostensibly remove a human from the process completely and have the robots write you a song.
Yeah.
And so that's the best synopsis I think I can give. I have for years known that the robots were going to kill us. I have known that for years. I just always thought they were going to shoot us. I didn't think they were going to starve us. And now now that I see, you know, even like I've seen robots here in LA delivering DoorDash.
Oh, yeah. I was at LAX the other night at the airport to pick up my wife, and there was a robot just sort of wandering around monitoring the parking area.
Yeah.
And so I pushed it over. No. but it was a little unnerving. Yeah. Like, okay, what are you monitoring?
We just came back from Japan. I saw a lot of robots there, right? Like information robots,
yeah,
in the train stations.
Yeah, yeah.
And over the years, when I see these developments, I would normally think, well, I have the most human of occupations.
Yes.
I'm an artist and songwriter and all that kind of stuff. And so I just didn't think that necessarily my job, not being an assembly line type job, was, you know, going to be either potentially threatened or replaced by,
right,
by the robots. And
You know what? I always had kind of a gut instinct. You've always felt replaceable in some, yeah, way to me that I couldn't quite put my finger on. I think,
and yet you've still been my friend for 30 years. You haven't found a way to replace me.
No, that's true. So yeah, there's something. There's something there. So I just typed into ChatGPT. I said, write me a breakup song in the style of Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
And this is pertinent because we're talking to Dar Williams today, and Dar wrote a book called How to Write a Song That Matters. And we really, in this conversation with her, kind of get into the nuts and bolts of what we kind of describe as the craft and the mystery of songwriting. And she really kind of takes us in some interesting places on her thoughts about how songs are put together and how they must resonate with your own soul. Like, you are the barometer of what is a song that matters, yeah, and what is a song that's good. When you remove that human element and you have a machine just sort of collating information that's available and doing something. So I just typed in here, write me a breakup song in the style of Taylor Swift. It spit out a full lyric. It's got two verses, chorus. It's got a bridge. And it says, we used to be in love. We used to be so bright. But now we're just strangers passing by in the night. I gave you my heart. I gave you my soul. But you tore it apart. And now I'm feeling so alone. You and I don't agree on hard rhyme versus soft rhyme. I'm already disturbed by the rhyming right, soul and alone here. Yeah. But what I'll say is, and let me read the chorus. It's time to let go, time to move on. I can't keep holding on to what's already gone. We had our moments, but they're in the past. I can't keep living in a love that didn't last. I wouldn't say that this is a good song.
Right.
But it is a song. I mean, this right, is clearly like, it has a verse, it has a chorus structure. It has some lines that you might be able to use this as a starting point and pluck out, yeah, some decent lines and build around them. It's, you know, it sounds, it doesn't sound fresh or interesting. It's, you know, but yeah, as you pointed out a moment ago, it's not going to get worse from here. This is the right, beginning of this technology.
Right. It's only going to get better.
Yeah.
You know, even just doing this, this is the first time that I've experimented with ChatGPT or any of the text generators. It's the first time I've experimented with AI as a songwriting tool. And it feels a bit like playing with a Ouija board to me right now. Like,
you're getting sweaty.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I know that this is a part of the future. I don't know what part of it is, you know,
right,
and the immediate future. So you know, you're not going to sit here and say, well, I'm not going to be party to any of this. But I will say, it's just, God, it just feels weird.
Yeah.
It just feels weird. And there's part of me that's kind of like encouraged by how crappy this lyric is.
Right. right.
Because, well, it's not very good.
There's an interesting conversation in this article that Caroline sent. And they're talking with Odie Blackman, who is not only a hit songwriter, he also teaches at MTSU outside of Nashville. He teaches in their songwriting program. And he kind of talks about how, you know, it's possible that ChatGPT could write like a number one hit song. But then he goes on and distinguishes, you know, there's songs that are of the moment and there's songs that are timeless. And not every song that's ever been a hit is necessarily a moving or emotional song.
Right.
Like, there have been hit songs that, like, they're just bangers and they feel good and people love to, you know, and but they're not necessarily like resonant in a an emotional way. And he was kind of saying, you know, AI might be a tool to help people write songs, and but he was saying it's hard for him to imagine that this is going to be something that generates timeless songs versus generating possibly a hit.
Well, yeah, I mean, this song right here is not Bonnie Raitt's "I Can't Make You Love Me."
Right.
But could that lyric be a number one song? Well, yeah, with the right beat and the right melody. I mean, there have been plenty of number one songs that had, you know, lame lyrics. So
yeah.
I think he's right about that. I've thought in my mind that we've been dealing with fast food for a long time.
Yeah.
And the idea that you can drive through a drive-through, and I don't know if there are humans making my food at McDonald's. It's probably a mix in there.
I don't know if it's even food.
Well, exactly. but they haven't replaced the steakhouse. Or,
right.
You know, maybe even more applicable here, the home-cooked meal.
Yeah.
Is still always considered kind of the, you know, the ultimate of the best thing you could eat. Oh, man, a home-cooked meal. And I feel like the place of the home-cooked meal song will always exist. And using that home-cooked meal analogy, I think, you know, is it going to be able to create a quantity of songs? Absolutely. Well, I think time will tell what kind of quality it creates.
Right.
But I do think that there is, you know, there's a bit of an existential threat here when it comes to the creative community, and it goes beyond just songwriting. I mean, we've seen a couple tracks come out in the past weeks where they can completely imitate voices.
Yeah.
Where you've got, you know, a song that they put out a song with supposedly Drake and The Weeknd on it, but it was an AI generated Drake and The Weeknd. And so because of this discussion and this debate and the shadow of this is being felt in all corners
right.
of the music community.
Right. And this does feel different than, you know, you can go back in the history of music. You mentioned drum machines, or the advent of Spotify. Like, that absolutely upended the music industry and changed the game completely. You could even go back to the 1940s and 50s and say that, you know, when amplification came in, that was a threat to big bands because you would need 20 musicians to play at a big dance hall so that people could even hear the music. And now, you know, with electric guitars and amps, you only need 4 guys. So there's 16 people who technology has potentially put them out of a job. And now we just look back at those things and take it for granted. But technology does play a role in creativity and commercialism.
Sure.
And, you know, as nervous as people were about jukeboxes replacing humans in a bar, you know, now we're at this point where we might look back in 10 years and go, oh, well, that was a little silly, you know, in the same way that we can't resonate with the fears of musicians in the 1940s and 50s.
Right.
But when it is your livelihood, when it is your passion, you know, almost even worse, you kind of go, this isn't just like the job that I do and I can just go get another job. Like, this is something, whether you are a professional writer or even if you're just a hobbyist, that, is there even a need for me to express my soul anymore?
Right.
Or am I going to be obsolete as a human being?
Yeah. And I, you know, honestly, I have gone back and forth with thinking about, you know, how do I respond to this? You know, even, you know, in my own mind, you know, I go back and forth because part of me just wants to dig in and say, no, this is not right. This is not cool. You can't replace writers with machines. And another part of me says, you know, am I going to have to adapt? Is this, you know, such a part of the future that I'm going to have to accommodate it? And to be honest with you, I don't know. You know, this makes me uncomfortable. It's different. I've been writing songs for 30-something years, man.
Yeah.
And having a computer spit out a bunch of lyrics is super wild.
Yeah, yeah.
But moving forward, I still don't see how it's going to completely replace us because, you know, that lyric right here that it just spit out needs some human help.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, you mentioned I Can't Make You Love Me. So I said, write a song in the style of Bonnie Raitt's I Can't Make You Love Me. It says, I'm sitting here alone, staring at the phone, wondering why you haven't called. You said you'd be here soon, but it's been so long, and I can't help but feel so small. That is terrible in comparison to turn down the lights, turn down the bed, turn totally. Down the voices inside my head. This is just not of the same caliber.
Right. It actually, in the chorus, it uses the same line, because I can't make you love me if you don't, right. by the way. It's that's more than in the style. But yeah, it's only going to get better.
I think, you know, it's like you can't bury your head in the sand. You can't close your eyes. So we have to open our eyes, but like keep an eyebrow arched, you know,
yes.
be a little suspicious,
right.
see where this goes. You don't want to just be, you know, a complete troglodyte and be like, I'm not gonna, you know, back right. to the fire and the cave, you know, but at the same time, there is something that's human about creativity. And if you remove humanity, that is a little terrifying.
I would suggest anyone go and read Nick Cave's open letter about AI. He's mad about it, you know, and but I think he does a good job of summarizing why the human experience is so important to songwriting. Because you're making a human connection. You're speaking a spiritual language when you write a song, and I don't think I'm overstating that point. That we resonate with one another's experiences, and we resonate with one another's just the color of life and what we've lived. And, you know, when I hear someone who's been through a painful experience while I'm going through one, there's actually kind of a communion that takes place. It'll be interesting to see if a machine can generate that and generate that feeling. But I still want to know who did this. I want to know the story. I want to feel connected to the artist and the writer. There's something encouraging to me about shared human experience rather than analyzed human experience, which is what this would be. It's like, well, we've watched humans. This is how humans would talk about this. So here you go. That's not terribly comforting to me when I'm listening to a song. I want to know that something I'm experiencing is being seen and experienced as well by that artist and by that writer.
Yeah, and I don't think this podcast would be as good if we were interviewing Hal from 2001 and we're like, so tell us about how you came up with that lyric. And it's
right.
like, I analyzed data from across right. the spectrum of songs that are known to the human experience and collated them. Rebecca, I think that's when we stopped the podcast.
It just hit me. This podcast is the most threatened by AI than anything else.
That's right. We'll have no one to talk to.
Can I say the most unscientific thing probably of all this, but it's been in my head for a while. It's like, if you guys are so smart, you AI nerds, if you guys are so smart, why are you trying to imitate Drake's voice? And why don't you fix the climate crisis? Like, if you got the ability to analyze data and come up with solutions and answers, why are you wasting time trying to sound like The Weeknd? Smart guys, there's so many more problems to fix.
Because, you know, at the end of the day, they want to be us.
That's what it is. The robots or the smart guys?
Definitely not the smart guys, the robots. Yeah. The robots want to be us. The smart guys, they're not concerned with us. But anyway, I think, you know, like I say, this is something we're going to watch. It's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds. And I think for now, the best we can do is I'm just going to get down the Ouija board and let's mess around with that
totally.
A little bit.
And in 6 months, the robot overlords who have replaced us at Songcraft will come and give you an update on how it's all gone.
Look, man, I know that this stuff is probably more worrisome to you. I mean, for me, it's kind of theoretical, but I know that you are a songwriter, so I don't want to leave you feeling stressed and twisted up. So I just typed into ChatGPT here, write a joke that will make my friend Paul the songwriter laugh. And I just want to share this joke with you that I came up with. Why did the songwriter go to the bank?
Well, there's a lot of answers to that. I don't know why.
To get his notes.
Oh my gosh.
I feel like this thing's been listening to us the whole time and it's twisting the knife by bringing up money.
I think this is like a banknote. Like, is this thing from the 30s?
Like, well, yeah, that's the joke. A banknote versus a musical note.
A bank. When have you said a banknote? Yeah. Right, I'm feeling better all the time.
Yeah. Well, you didn't laugh, and I asked it to write a joke that would make you laugh. So
no, I didn't. If this thing is coming up with things saying like banknotes, and it's going to follow it up with like, you know, let me know when the bread truck's going to be by and the ice truck
to get his doubloons.
Then, yeah, maybe I'm not so worried.
Part two.
Dar, welcome to Songcraft.
Thank you.
It's great to speak with you. There's a lot that we have to talk about songwriting. We know that you have some great insights and thoughts about the art and craft and mystery and voodoo that is songwriting. But before we start getting into that, I'd love to hear a bit about your growing up years. And I understand that you grew up outside New York City and started playing guitar when you were a kid. I'd love to just hear a bit about some of those earliest musical memories and some of those early musical impressions that opened your ears and made you think or put that spark in you that this would be something you'd want to pursue one day.
Well, we had a musical family, but that was, I don't know if we would have been that musical if we hadn't been really in that big heyday of the 60s and 70s when it was just normal for people to make music together. I mean, I hope that they do it now too, but you know, we had a holiday party, a holiday block party every year, and the kids had to learn songs for that. And there was a lot of singing with their parents. There was caroling and there was all this stuff, music in the schools. And I remember my sister coming home in tears when she was 9, because they had put out all of these instruments on the cafeteria stage and said, you can take one of these home if you want. My sister said, I don't know if it's going to be okay with mom, but there's a violin out there in the woods that I brought home. So there was something, of course, my parents were thrilled. And there was this kind of, okay, you're 9. What instrument are you going to play? And I chose guitar because my older sister played guitar. And it's something that I'm not sure if we have as much of at this point. There was, what instrument are you going to play and how are you going to get out and play it? And you know, how are you going to have music in your life? That was sort of one of those big kind of laid back, cool 70s questions.
Right.
You know, and mad respect to your parents for their response to that violin, because I've always thought that in the hands of children, the two most terrifying instruments are the violin and the clarinet.
Yeah, it was, you know, it turned out my sister had, I just remember her going in for her lessons, and there were these two teachers, you know, from the school who also taught privately, and they were hanging out together, the band teacher and the orchestra teacher, and one of them looked at my mom and said, she's got a good ear. And the other one said, she's got two good ears. And I just remember this sort of, you know, and my sister just glowed, and she does have an incredible ear. And it would not, she wouldn't have done any of that if she hadn't been invited in that direction. I was the big monkey, you know, I was the clown who was like, let's try this, let's try that. But that was the great thing. There's a great picture of my friend, Michael, with, he's playing a harmonica, and his head, so he's sort of perpendicular, and his head is on the stomach of his friend who is playing guitar, you know, kind of with the guitar up near his face. So Michael could have his, and they're like, and they're wearing those, you know, little tight shorts from the 70s, and they're sort of in their early teens, but there just seemed to be this way that people kind of hung out under trees and with their heads on each other's stomach playing harmonica, that I associate with a really golden time, you know, something that we should aspire to.
Right. Well, talk to us about, you know, being a kid and not only playing music, but then starting to come up with original ideas. And I guess really what I'm asking is tell us about the first song you ever wrote.
I was 11 and it was, you know, I started to form the song and, you know, play with it in my head and start to form it. And it's, somebody said, you know, has your songwriting practice changed? And I think, actually, no, I think when I was 11, I had this little melodic thing it was a song called I Should Be Happy Where I Am. And I think that was the line that came into my head. And I thought, gosh, what, I should be happy where I am. What does that mean? What does that pull up for me? What's interesting to me? What's pretty to me? You know, that's what I say to people about songwriting all the time. Like, here are the big two scientific rules of proceeding with your song. What sounds pretty? What sounds interesting to you? You know, and then go from there. So that's what happened. And I've played at a lot of summer camps now. I went around for a few summers and played at different summer camps just to introduce myself. And it was a lot of fun. And I've learned that it's, summer camp is a real privilege. And I went to one, you know, that I think was pretty pricey, although I've been to a lot of Girl Scout camps that are open to all. I played it at my summer camp for one of the counselors. And she said, you have to play that for the camp. And because it's not, you know, your permanent community, it's your summer community. And it's all about that kind of warm fuzziness. I played my song for the whole camp. And they said, now you have to put it in the camp newspaper. And all of these counselors and people who knew this was their job came up to me and said, it's so amazing that you wrote a song. Like, I can't believe you did that. That's amazing. I couldn't do that. And I really held that in my heart. And then I wrote another song and one of my friends was like, that sounds like the first one. So of course I didn't write another song till I was like 15. And by then I was into theater. So so I was writing songs for, you know, plays and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned theater, and you actually majored in theater and religion when you went to college. And you know, I'm sitting there kind of connecting the dots in my mind and thinking about, you know, the time spent sort of studying the introspective nature of the human soul, and then the things that you sort of get out on stage in terms of, you know, just performance. And I'm curious about how those two disciplines were married in your mind and in your life at the time. I mean, looking back, you can see how that would definitely funnel into the life of a songwriter. But at the moment, how did you see those two kind of working together?
Yeah, I always saw them as related. You are, and I think being interested in the human soul, it, you know, it's kind of how we form these ideas of things that are really important to us. And how we create the whole inner schemata, you know, the inner stage plot of all that, and then how we express it in the world, whether it's through, you know, ritual, which is very theatrical, or through theater, which is very, can be very ritualistic too. You know, I always was interested in sort of how it formed on the inside, how the outside, you know, world influenced how we kind of create our little inner stage plots, and then how we share that with each other. And as you said about songcraft, you know, you're like the crafting, the writing, the voodoo. You know, I have friends who are involved with voodoo, as it were. You know, there's a lot of kind of let the magic be what it is. But of course, when you're studying this stuff, you're trying to figure out what that magic is. And I was very interested in why and how we took those things that were very important to us and shared them in these very stylized, beautiful ways, and why that was important to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, by the early 90s, you were living in Boston, and one of your earliest kind of recorded moments, I guess, was appearing on a compilation called Boston Women's Voices, which included the song You're Aging Well, which you wrote and recorded that was included there.
In the morning, you wake up and the signs point to you. They say, I'm so glad that you finally made it here. Thought nobody cared, but I did, I could tell. And this is your year, and it always starts here. And oh, you're aging well.
that's a song that went on to later be covered by Joan Baez. And that got me thinking a little bit. You were talking about that camp counselor who said, you know, people need to hear this song. And then you have somebody like Joan Baez, who is an icon, recording one of your songs. And I think one of the things we don't talk about enough in terms of songwriting development is the outside voice. It's the recognition of someone else saying that's good, or someone else saying you should do that. You know, if you don't have that in your life, I think it's easy for people to feel discouraged or to feel like, well, maybe, you know, my songs aren't any good. And I would imagine that having someone like Joan Baez, who has gone on to cover a number of your songs, kind of give that validation, probably taps into the same thing that the summer camp counselor taps into of like, hey, you're good. You should do this. Talk a bit about the role of the encouraging voice in terms of developing one's craft and continuing on.
I think it's everything. I think there's a few things around what you're saying that I think are extremely important. One is that, you know, we do have this thing that there's like this kind of script that people have about their success that makes it very much, you know, that plays right into that whole American exceptionalism thing where they say, you know, I had this dream and nobody believed it, but I did. And, you know, my parents didn't support me and nobody supported me, but I knew. And so I did it. And that's fantastic. But it's not necessary. What I consider to be, you know, my path and also the path of a lot of people around me is that, yeah, you do feel a little different than other people. That can happen. And therefore you kind of put out your calling card and hang your shingle through your art and through the way you express yourself. But then there's that one person, maybe a teacher, who says, I recognize that sign, that sign that you've hung up. That there's a whole world that feels the way you do. There's a tribe out there for you. I do understand how people feel a little different than other people and therefore put their own sort of way of thinking onto paper to just say, I exist, I'm valid. This is who I am, and I'm not like these other people. And I can see how that has a very exclusive, apart from everybody, feel. But then there's that moment where somebody says, here's your campfire. And what I encourage people to do, when people say, you know, my kiddo wants to be a professional songwriter, I always encourage them. The one piece of advice I give them is to send their kids off to a city that has a scene, because Boston had a scene. Open mics, tip jar gigs, even college radio interviews, and promoters who understand that developing artists is important to the whole sort of this all off the beaten track subgenre, and put you in front of national acts. That Boston had all of those things and continues to, so that you can kind of trial and error yourself and, you know, find friendly voices and not so friendly voices to kind of swim around with your songs. I was part of a scene that was probably at the end of the day, maybe 20 people of an incredible range of abilities and what they did with their lives. A lot of people could have gone on to continue being professional musicians, but made a hybrid music and another career go of it. Other people went full time, Vance Gilbert and Ellis Paul, Jonathan Brook, Patty Griffin was there at the time. A bunch of us, you know, went into full time careers, and a lot of people didn't at all and are still showing up at shows and still go to open mics and play songs. And within that world of voices, there was a lot of competition. There was a lot of sleeping around. There were a lot of people showing up at open mics singing songs about the person in that scene who just dumped them and slept with another person in the scene. You know, like, there's all of that. But I think that's healthy. I think that finding a place, a real place to swim around in is really helpful and important, inspiring, you know, and motivating and affirming to musicians.
Yeah, yeah. Well, after you made a couple of cassette-only recordings, you really made your first proper album with The Honesty Room, which came out in 1993, was later picked up for distribution by Razor and Tie, which was your longtime label. But I want to ask you about the first song on The Honesty Room, When I Was a Boy.
I was a kid that you would like, just a small boy on her bike, riding topless, yeah, I never cared who saw. My neighbor came outside to say, get your shirt, I said no way, it's the last time, I am not breaking any law. And now I'm in this clothing store, and the signs say less is more, more that's tight means more to see, more for them, not more for me. That can't help me climb a tree, 10 seconds flat, when I was a boy. See that picture, that was me, grass-stained shirt and dusty knees. And I know things have gotta change. They got pills to sell, they got implants to put in, they got implants to remove. But
lead track kind of functions as the introduction to your book, How to Write a Song That Matters. Mm-hmm. And I want to get a little bit more into the title of the book in a bit, but tell a bit about how that song came together, because you write about that beautifully in the introduction of the book, and how that process and the self-doubt and sort of the approach to writing was a unique experience that has kind of informed your approach to following your heart as you have continued to write for many years since.
That song was definitely When I Was a Boy was definitely the template of how I could talk to myself about writing songs. I mean, I'd already written maybe, you know, 30 songs before that one, but there was such a line to cross, such a distinct line to cross, where I said to myself, okay, so this line has come into my head. It's When I Was a Boy. I'm going to write this song called When I Was a Boy. I'm going to think about all those experiences where I felt like a boy. And I'm already feeling kind of funny about it because I'm a feminist, and I know that my feminist friends would say, when you were like a boy, when you were a girl who could do everything that a boy could do, you know. Mm-hmm. I already knew that there was, could be some pushback against a woman singing When I Was a Boy. In the midst of that sort of awareness that I was going to follow the When I Was a Boy line, I came to a third verse where I thought, okay, so when I was a boy, I was able to run around without a shirt on, and I was able to run around with the other boys, quote unquote. And I would, you know, I ran around and did dangerous things like other boys. Okay, what's this third verse going to be? Oh gosh, I think really how it rings true for me is to have a man who says, when I was a girl, I could pick flowers, I could talk to my mom, I could cry, I was kinder.
And so I tell the man I'm with about the other life I lived. And I say, now your top gun I have lost and you have won. And he says, oh no, no, can't you see? When I was a girl, my mom and I, we always talked. And I picked flowers everywhere that I walked. And I could always cry. Now even when I'm alone, I seldom do. And I have lost some kindness, but like me. And I was just like you.
So the line that was really important for me to cross was the, that's really not going to ring true for my crowd, for my feminist, you know, radical feminist community. And it doesn't ring true for sort of the way that the way these songs go. You know, when you're writing a feminist song, you don't include men. You don't feel sorry for men. But I did, you know, because right. Anyone who's seen me, I look like everyone's sister. Like I look like your sister. And or, you know, somebody's sister, the kind of, you know, like the sister that would go with you to the prom, you know, that would go with your buddy to the prom because she felt bad that he didn't have a date. Like I look like that. Yeah. So men have confided in me forever. And they would always say, I'm not like other men because, you know, I was kinder. I liked to pick flowers. I liked hanging out with my mom all the time. So I thought, this is what's going to happen. And I'm going to cross that line. I'm going to make that the end of my song. And that is the whole reason that I have a career, because wow. It was two things. One, it opened up a world of conversation for men with me, you know, and in my audiences, which really meant the world to me and was really exciting. And it also was a gender song at a time when we didn't see gender as sort of the underlying conversation of sexual orientation, feminism, and even transsexuality. You know, there's just a baseline gender thing. Like, what the hell does that mean? To be a female, to be male, that now we have a lot. So I kind of was getting there to something under the surface, unbeknownst to me, just because I decided to cross that line and write something that felt honest to me. So, you know, that's why I'm able to lead a whole songwriting retreat sort of based on what feels honest to you. Proceed step by step and check in with yourself. Does this really feel like what really happened, what you really feel, where you really went when you went someplace that you're describing in the song?
Yeah.
Well, you really had your finger on the pulse of something important, even at that kind of early stage in your career, because I think even the very fact that there was a conversation about the title was a win. If someone says, no, you should call it something else, the fact that you've got something that's provoking conversation and provoking interest just, you know, draws ears and eyes to the song. I even think about a title like The Christians and the Pagans. You know, you see that and you go, I think I need to listen to that. I think I need to know what's inside of that song.
The food was great. The tree plugged in. The meal had gone without a hitch till Timmy turned to Amber and said, is it true that you're a witch? His mom jumped up and said the pies are burning, and she hit the kitchen, and it was Jane who spoke. She said, it's true, your cousin's not a Christian, but we love trees, we love the snow, the friends we have, the world we share, and you find magic from your gut, and we find magic everywhere. So the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground, the best that they were able. And where does magic come from? I think magic's in the learning, 'cause now when Christians sit with pagans, only pumpkin pies are burning.
Talk a little bit about the importance of a title.
I would say for me that it's more sort of the importance of that spine that the title represents. Certainly if somebody picked up my thing and it said The Christians and the Pagans, when I was a boy, you're aging well, they would probably get a sense of what they're about to hear.
Right.
But those songs that had very clear and interesting titles might have drawn some people in, but then drew them into just the material in general. I was traveling a lot by the time I did The Honesty Room, you know, just trying to find gigs at empty open mics in Arizona or something. So I was seeing this world, a certain social frontier that we weren't seeing on the news, of that was much more inclusive and reflective and self-questioning and, you know, about sustainability and alternative religions and cultures than we would see on the news. So I just wrote about that frontier. And that turned out to really have a listening audience. So, you know, paganism, we really have to applaud ourselves for how far we've come with the gender conversation, the religion conversation. I mean, there's things that seemed really sort of edgy at the time, like paganism. And now we're just like, yeah, we've got a lot of religions. We get it.
Yeah.
So I think sort of the oeuvre of what I did kind of had its own interesting niche audience from the start, and kind of grew via the grapevine of people in that sort of alternative but growing sort of culture.
Yeah.
Well, and you listen to a song like The Christians and the Pagans, and it's sort of grappling with this idea of, you know, finding common ground amidst awkwardness, you know, and mm-hmm. When I Was a Boy has something to say about gender and what's acceptable societally about what our expectations are. But, you know, you listen to a song like As Cool As I Am from that second album, Mortal City. And, you know, that whole record, I mean, The Christians and the Pagans is a little bit more of an acoustic-y type song, mm-hmm. but you really explored, you know, you listen to As Cool As I Am, and that's a song that grabs you sonically, whereas a lot of the first album was a little bit more acoustic. And even As Cool As I Am is still acoustic, but it's like a more full band, like in-your-face kind of produced approach.
If you turn to me, you say you hope I'm not threatened. Oh, 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 I'm not that petty. As cool as I am, I thought you'd know this already. I will not be afraid of women. I will not be afraid of women.
The songs we've talked about thus far are I think probably songs where there's a lot to unpack lyrically, but we haven't talked much about presentation, you know, how a song is produced. Like you can take a song and make an acoustic recording of it, and you can take the exact same song and do a fully produced recording and it's the same song, but it comes across very different, or it has a different effect on the listener. I'd like to get your thoughts on kind of your instincts on when you write, when you finish a song. Do you kind of have a sense of, man, this is a song that's just stripped down and needs to stay that way? Or do you kind of hear production and presentation in your head as you're actually writing and finishing up a new song?
I will have a sonic landscape for my songs when I write them. I tend to, but I really learned my lesson, about that I've always worked with people who are really great and great listeners and who both have great ideas, but who also are really wonderful about hearing my ideas. But I did an album called The Green World with Stuart Lerman, who just brought in these really great musicians. He's got wonderful ears and wonderful ideas, but another wonderful thing he does is he brought in his buddy Stuart Smith, who is now in the Eagles, and Graham Mabey from who plays a lot with Joe Jackson and is like a really beloved bass player. Steve Holly, who had been in Wings and who played with Ian Hunter and was just, you know, and played with everybody basically. And Rob Hyman of the group The Hooters, who also did a lot of co-writing and production for Cyndi Lauper and Joan Osborne. So he brought in these musicians who all had their own sensibility, their own take, their own, you know, way that they proceeded musically. And I had such a specific sense in my mind of how I wanted these songs to go, that I that I said to them, like, well, no, this is what I'm hearing. This is what I'm hearing. And they all nodded because they're also just seasoned musicians. So they didn't argue with me, but they would sometimes just step out and do their own thing. And I wouldn't hear it at first. I wouldn't hear what was so special and interesting about what they were doing until a couple of weeks later, when I just let the song be on its own terms and be on the terms of these great musicians. Huh. And I realized that as much as I didn't regret some of the micromanaging ideas that I'd had, I wanted to, for the next album, sit back and trust them more, which is what I did working with the same musicians, basically, on The Beauty of the Rain.
Yeah.
And I can hear the difference in terms of my control over how everything went between those two albums. And sitting back on the couch and letting them do their thing and just appreciating it and letting it live with me, I think made for a you know, it was a great next album to do. And it taught me to sit back more in the studio.
You know, that raises an interesting question, because where at one time we might have talked in terms of sales, we kind of now talk in terms of streams. And the song The Beauty of the Rain, the title track from that record, is your most streamed song on Spotify. So that's the one that folks have heard the most.
You can look out of your window at the storm, but you watch the phone and hope it rings. You take her any way she sings, or how she calls. The beauty of the rain is how it falls, how it falls, how it falls, how it falls, how it falls.
I wonder if, you know, you have any sense of perhaps surrendering yourself to that process in that way, gave a certain comfortability, gave a certain sense of, you know, I'm surrendering in a way to this song, that this song is, I'm trusting this process and I'm trusting these songs and how they're coming to life in a way that makes for the perfect package. You know, you've got this great song, mm-hmm. it's delivered in the right way, and you're letting go a little bit. And mm-hmm. I wonder if it's, you know, if there's any coincidence there, that it just so happens that when you kind of surrendered yourself to that particular process, that winds up being a song that particularly resonates with people. Like, you're almost letting the song guide the process a little bit, if that makes any sense.
Well, I'm a definite, I believe in magic person. So I would say absolutely. I will also say, sort of in terms of how that song lived in the real world, it was featured in at least two TV shows. One was Alias, and more recently it was in The Affair. And I think it also might have been in the TV show Party of Five. So
right.
There was some of that, like, who's that? And also Chris Bode, there's a beautiful trumpet part in Beauty of the Rain. And that's Chris Bode who did that. And I think that it just kind of, it floats so beautifully, and in a way that I think went really well on TV shows.
You know, right.
Just, it sort of sounded like a rainy city street.
Well, there's kind of that balance, right? There's the magic and what resonates with people, but you also can't discount a really nice sync placement.
No, sync placements really take things. They they really bring a lot of stuff into the end zone. So that was that. But there is a looseness in that album that I think, I mean, there were some good syncs from that album, but also from The Green World. So I'm not sure, but you're right. Beauty of the Rain is the most streamed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad that we've spent some time talking about sort of the musical bed in which your music lives, because I think your criticism of singer-songwriter output tends to be way too lyric focused, in my opinion, because these are songs after all. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. There's some things that you talk about in your book, even in terms of chord structure and how you use chords and how chords are put together. I love this section talking about chords like they're a sandwich. a simple sandwich versus a sandwich with some more ingredients in it. And I'd love to get you to kind of expound upon that, because I'm already butchering it, and you did it so well.
No, you're not. That's very, I mean, I have two analogies that I use for music, because part of which is because I've gotten a lot of people at my songwriting retreat who consider themselves to be casualties of conservatories or just rigorous music programs, where they were told that they just didn't have it, you know, with a capital I. So there's something really great about knowing a chord, you know, saying, oh no, I want an A minor seventh here, not an A minor. There's so many different moods that each of these different, you know, iterations of a chord can have. But so I created two analogies. One is that instead of calling the chords that live with other chords keys, I call them houses. So C lives in a house with the F and the G, which is, you know, 1, 4, 5, and all the, you know, there's all the theory words for it. They live in a house together, and each of them have their moods, their wistful moods, their porch, you know, sitting on the porch mood, their sad mood. And when you're proceeding narratively, you know, it's really helpful to know what the housemates of the key that you've chosen are. You know, if I'm starting in a C, it's just good to know that I'll probably want to go to an F or a G as I'm step-by-step proceeding. And then I'll play around with those different moods. And then if I'm not finding exactly what I want, if I want to extend myself out a little bit, I can just, you know, hop on over to my neighbor's house and grab a chord from their house, like the key of D. I'll often jump over and just grab a C and bring it back into my house for my song. So by creating that visual, my friend Katrina Neilds actually drew little houses just so people could really see, you know, you just, okay, I'm going to reside in this house and I can trip over and grab a chord from that house, but then I'm going to be in this house and, you know, really dig into all these moods. That was one way that I was trying to demystify music theory. The other was to say that when you're creating a chord, you know, there's a minor, you can have you have your one and your five, and you can have a major third or a minor third. I'm not even sure if it's a one and a five. I think it is. Anyway, you can have a minor third, which is, you know, you count this many up from your C note, or your major third, counting, you know, another number up, will decide whether you're going to have a happy sandwich or a sad sandwich. And that's the first kind of, you know, so it's like the one and the five are the pieces of bread, and then you stick something in the middle. But then, of course, it gets complicated, or arguably fun, because you can also change the bread. And you can also, yes, add a fourth. You know, you can have really interesting thirds, but you can also add a fourth, you know, note to you can have a triad, but then there's also four note things that you can play with.
Which, and I love, yes. You referred to a four note chord as being referred to as a four note chord.
Right, right. I'm like, okay, so, you know, there's the two, it's just a dyad, and then you can have three notes, which you call it a triad, and then there's four notes, which is apparently just called four notes.
Yeah, it doesn't
and that
get a
sandwich
fancy name.
Would be more like, you know, a BLT with avocado, yeah. You know, it's just, you just add an extra, but again, it's your song, and it's your playing around and enjoying stuff, knowing as much as you know to help you communicate with other people or to replicate it for yourself, or kind of know how to proceed. You know, I want a wistful mood. Oh, I know that I want a minor seventh instead of a major seventh, you know, as much as you know, great. But as much as you don't know, you can still write a song. We listen to thousands of songs, so we're already fluent by the time we sit down to write our own. We already have an internalized fluency of how to proceed in writing a song, you know, in Western civ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that, you know, partly because Sad Sandwich is my favorite indie shoegazer band. So I love that you referenced them. but number two, you know, occasionally we'll get an email from somebody that's like, why don't you talk more about the nuts and bolts of what goes into a song, you know, quarterly and things like that. So I think you're actually buying us a little bit of time and love from our audience who have wanted to hear this kind of red meat, and you're giving it to them, and we love it.
Yeah, my wonderful friend Rick Gedney, who is at the retreat with me, what we call what he does musical narratives, because he's so wonderful at helping a person kind of, you know, just add an interesting twist here and there. It takes so little to do so much, so that it is worth it to you know, enjoy how much you can do with a single chord without feeling daunted, or like if you don't know all the numbers, you're not allowed to write a song. You're always allowed to write a song.
Yeah, right. Well, your seventh album, Promised Land, came out in 2008, and there, I believe, were more co-writes on that album than there had been on the previous, which I think there were only three co-writes, but typically most of your material had been solo written prior to that. And then similarly, the follow-up album, In the Time of Gods, there were four co-written songs, but in that instance, they were all co-written with Rob Hyman, whom you'd mentioned earlier, including the song Summer Child, which is one of the more popular songs from that record. The summer child is running, the summer child is running again. The summer child is running, the summer child is running again. When you hear the feet and the sound of laughter, better step aside for the mayhem after. Here she comes, yeah, the summer child's running again. As we kind of talk about this nuts and bolts thing, you know, there's writing in isolation, and then there is collaborating. I'd love to hear a bit about your approach to collaboration, what you think that kind of brings to the process that's different from writing solo, and then also what makes a great collaborator, because obviously in the, you know, instance of In the Time of Gods, it wasn't a list of collaborators, it was Rob Hyman. You found somebody that you work with well. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that co-writing process.
It's so great to write with other people. It's this really weird, like, you're really making something out of nothing. And when I'm doing something on my own, I know, you know, all of the stuff around me that I'm going to put into that nothing. You know, I just have that one scrap of melody, and then I kind of know how to build around it. And with another person, it's like they're bringing all of these things. And without just a very soft, slow, kind, stepping forward, this is how I would do it, this is how I would do it, you're just going to reach an impasse. And so people who write songs together kind of know to come in with their, you know, big listening ears, and their open minds and their open hearts to themselves as well as the other person. Like, this is going to seem really weird at first. I don't know you, you don't know me, and this is a really interesting way to get to know each other. What happens is, what was great with Rob is that his sense of musical narration is so great, and I already know that he thinks that I'm really weird, you know. Like, I'll just be like, I want to write a song that's an anthem about recycling, and I'll be like, well, let's see how that goes, you know. Like, don't. And actually, watching the Hooters, they played with me on a Joe Strummer song that I covered, gosh, watching them listen to each other, trust each other, you know, accept and include every outrageous idea before they collectively decided whether to keep it or chuck it, was a thing of beauty. Cause these guys have been playing together for over 30 years when we were doing that. Rob, would hear this idea, that idea, and say, sure, let's just, we just kept on throwing stuff out together. And then he would kind of keep on creating this musical sculpture on which to hang these ideas as they, you know, the musical narrative of whatever I was saying. So that, that was amazing. So, so Rob was great because, he would just take anything I was, saying and sort of help magically spin it into what I was saying musically. And at one point there's this beautiful thing that he did where I was singing a song called "This Is How I'll Free Myself." And there's this person who is, sort of relating these little pictures of his life where he's saying, you know, my friends and I, we were sipping the last drops of this, you know, beautiful old scotch, and then tramping through the hills, singing "Auld Lang Syne." And you just get a sense that this person is never sober and that they're really trying to weave a sense of a meaningful life out of a life where, you know, they're never, sober. And, there's this one thing where, and so it's very sad, like it's a very sad sandwich, as we would say. There's a lot of sad chords in it. And at the end of one of these, couplets, Rob looked at me and put in a seventh chord, which is what I call a very porchy chord, a very sort of, what's today going to bring? And it absolutely shed this light on that aspect of an alcoholic's life when they're like, maybe I'm not getting away with this, but maybe I am. And it was so beautiful because it brought out that hope that person has, you know, as they're trying to wrestle meaning, you know, out of these images of their lives.
We shook the last drops from Glengarry's finest hour. We sipped it like the blood of birds. Through the mountain time, belting old lang syne. This is
So Rob was totally cool about pushing the envelope on musical narratives and always kind of looking at me with his eyebrows raised. And I would look at him with my eyebrows raised, like, what about this? What about this? Mm-hmm. And then he was also really good about knowing when to break for lunch. So that's right. Really helpful. I worked with one guy who I had this one line, and it's always helpful to come in with just like one line, just one melodic line, sometimes with words, and say, you know, let's go from here. You know, you always start by saying, you know, so what do you have anything that you want to start with? I came into one guy and and he took that line that I saw as the end of a phrase and he made it the beginning of this other thing. And he started to do all this stuff with it. And I said, oh, that's not what I'd expected. I heard it as the end to a line. So let me just wrap my mind around, you know, it being the beginning of a line and this new key that you're bringing it into, this key shift that you're introducing. And he said, yeah, you know, I've heard your songs. And from what I've heard, you could use a little bit more, you know, variation. And I just thought, jeez. This session's over, you know, yeah, and totally. We kept on working on it, but I was like, I had nothing, you know, the manhole cover was like, covered the hole all the way. Like I was just, rigid. I had nothing, I wasn't with a person I trusted. Yeah. And so we had a lovely coffee. We had a lovely thing. I knew that I wasn't going to go home and write on whatever, you know, whatever we bled from that stone of a session. It was just And I, the person, I won't say who it is, obviously, I love him. Mm. He's just really very literal and very, you know, I totally understand the way he communicates. He's all about his rituals and his structures. Yeah. But I couldn't proceed with him.
Well, he didn't realize that he was actually repeating a moment from your story that you just told us from playing that song at camp. And someone's like, oh, that sounds like your song from last year.
Right.
And it's like
this, the manhole cover.
Yeah, this guy just like pulled childhood trauma out in the middle of the session.
It's, I think that's probably a pretty instructive thing to point to. It doesn't take much to derail us. And that's why that whole, like, I had a dream and I stuck to the dream. And I, you know, it's like, what does that mean? That seems so sort of like the Platonic ideal. Like, I knew that that thing was sitting there in the middle of the stone and I just, you know, carved away. really, we live in a world, you know, we live in a world that where we are soft and we are permeable. And those criticisms and things that people say, get in there. I mean, but what's interesting, conversely, is that when I was in Boston, there was so much, competitive stuff. People were like, Dar, you should just quit. Your falsetto, you have bad diction in your falsetto. You have a shitty, you have bad guitar, you know, like just all this, like, yeah, you've got a really bad guitar. Maybe you should quit. You know, your songs aren't making sense to me. Maybe you should quit. You know, all the people who tell me to quit are now my buddies, but you know, there was plenty of that, but then there was plenty of, you know, a person who had shown up at the open mic with a friend who was like, no, I like that song. I think you should keep going. So a little bit goes a long way in the positive realm as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had said I wanted to come back to the title of your book, which I do, but it's called How to Write a Song That Matters. And it's not called How to Write a Hit Song. I'd like to get your thoughts on that distinction.
You know, I can get so, I can be so blithe about, you know, how writing a song that matters is the way to go, because the songs that I wrote that mattered to me ended up being the most successful. And the ones that I sat down and wrote with an ear towards being more poppy and more, you know, ear friendly to the radio did get played on the radio, but the songs that really have brought people back to concerts were the ones that mattered to me the most, such as When I Was a Boy. As Cool as I Am was both, and Christians and Pagans was both, but I have a song called After All that has to do with, you know, my climb up from clinical depression. And that's one of the most important songs for that people request. I think, you know, that gets requested the most.
And when I chose to live, there was no joy. It's just a line I crossed. Wasn't worth the pain my death would cost, so I was not lost or found. And if I was to sleep, I knew my family had more truth to tell. So I traveled down a whispering well to know myself through them.
Even when I was in Nashville doing co-writing with people, we would look at each other and say, what matters to you? What's interesting to you? What matters to you? As opposed to, what does everyone out there want to hear these days? And I think a lot of the books play on this, that I see play on this kind of, do you have what it takes to write a hit song? And, you know, like they do in Nashville. In Nashville, you sit there and you go, okay, just tell me like three of your deepest secrets, person I've never met before. I'll tell you three of mine. Okay, now we're off and running. Right. And, you know, there's the personal is an important ingredient in every co-write and every solitary write that I've done. So, but writing a song that matters, I fear that people think that that means, you know, matters to the world and is political and, The truth is, it's just the opposite. It's whatever is delightful, funny, interesting, sort of whimsically engaging, and important to you and me, the songwriters.
Yeah.
The book is basically how we kind of follow that voice of fascination, you know, how we use that fascination to follow along. And so I there's things like that I've learned from leading a retreat. Like I say, okay, where did you go? What happened or what's happening? How does it feel? How did it feel? Hmm. So, you know, like just figuring out what is the terrain here? Is it another planet? Okay. Sit in a chair and imagine that other planet, you know, does everyone have three boobs and the mountains are purple? Okay. You know, like just look at that whole landscape and you'll draw from it. And you might draw one or two things from that landscape that you're either seeing in front of you or creating in your mind. But, you know, go, you know, where did you go? Okay. So you have the landscape. So what happened, you know, what really happened? You went there and, you know, you went to this planet and you expected to be, scared and you turn and, but what really happened is that you were bored and you wanted to come back to Earth, you know, what really happened right. will be a very instructive thing to make your song unique and ideally kind of hit that strike zone of things where you're like, I'm not sure if this applies to everybody else or anybody else. And then it does, you know, it's sort of in this strike zone of the collective unconscious. And then, you know, how did it feel? Did the feeling have a color, have a musical narrative, you know, did it have a minor or a seventh-y feel or a major seventh feel to it? So I call the retreat Writing a Song That Matters and the book How to Write a Song That Matters, because it's like, how do we just quietly suss out what matters to us by just proceeding step by step, saying, oh, what happened next? Okay, so does that, you know, does that feel right? Does that feel right? And ideally, by saying what's interesting to me, what's pretty to me, arguably you are creating something meaningful and beautiful, at least for yourself, but usually for more than just yourself. And that can still be like a total head banging metal song that's more musical narrative than lyrical narrative. That's cool. Like yeah. if you would just want to write, you know, some of my favorite songs are Low Rider, which is it's just like low rider.
Right.
And then that cool, you know, trumpet thing. Da, 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 da. Like I could listen to that on repeat for eternity.
Right.
Yeah.
And another one is the Todd Rundgren song, I don't want to work. I just want to bang on my drum all day. Like right. that's fantastic, you know, and that, so, you know,
unlikely influences, I'm going to say too.
Sorry, what?
Like those are unlikely. If I was going to say, what are Dar Williams' two favorite songs? I'd be like, well, let's see. I don't know if I would have picked those two.
Oh my gosh. My favorite song. It's so much weirder than that. I love the song, Endless Love. I love anything by Barry Manilow. Like his sense of melody and, you know, what I say when people come in is that, you know, another thing that we can sort of ask ourselves and discover step by step is what is the voice of this song? And if it's really sentimental and you like that, then go for it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and maybe you'll make a lot of money, but it's got to have its own integrity to itself and its own truth to itself. And Low Rider, Shatter, I love by the Rolling Stones, Shattered, like Shatter, mm-hmm. you know, it's like these songs that are just so true to themselves have their own interior logic, and you can just tell that the songwriter had so much fun and paid attention to what the song was asking to do.
Yeah.
Those are the songs I fear that the saying a song that matters means like this is going to keep us from fighting World War III. You know, I don't mean it in the 60s sense. I mean it in the matters to you because it just wakes you up and is interesting to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm hearing a lot of what you're saying, even in some of your more recent music. The album before your most recent was Emerald. And, you know, I listened to a song like Something to Get Through, and it's got this cool steel guitar part, but it's got these kind of beatly chord changes.
But it's really just a drag. It won't get any worse. It's not your special fate. It's not an evil curse.
then I listen to a song like You Give It All Away from your most recent album, I'll Meet You Here. And you've got horns and you've got organ. You've got kind of this classic soul influence thing going on.
I see what you see, and I hope the world is watching. Oh, they're gonna love the way you say the things you do. They don't know what's in store, they never seen the likes of this before. And oh, you're gonna give it all away.
Those are different influences, but the thing that strikes me about those songs is I still feel like I'm listening to a Dar Williams song. You know, I'm not like, oh, she's doing a caricature of this or that. Instead, you're pulling influences from different types of music that might not necessarily even be music that's associated with you, but you're incorporating some of that into what you do and still making it your own. And I feel like that's kind of what you're saying here is for people to have that open mind, draw from all kinds of influences, but don't imitate. Soak up those things and let them form themselves to where you can then write what matters to you and is uniquely yours and has your fingerprints, versus I'm going to try to go write my own version of Shattered by the Rolling Stones and make something that sounds just like that. It's like, no, I'm going to absorb that and the spirit of that and what that is, but then I'm going to apply that to who I am and what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I would also say sometimes I was writing a song called It Happens Every Day. And I said, oh, this is my Ron Sexsmith song. And, right. and I thought maybe, we absorb things, but maybe sometimes things aren't even all the way absorbed. And sometimes it sounds like that other person. And then your job is just hide it, hide it, hide it. I say, if you have a line that sounds, like, oh my gosh, this is, Waterloo by ABBA, just change two or three notes and right. No one will be the wiser. Just, just hide it.
Right.
But yeah, I would say, but I hear what you're saying. Like, I think there's definitely a difference between saying, I want to write, I'm going to sit down and write my version of this thing, versus, there was a person who wanted to write a song about a historical person in her extended family, who was really interesting, like a cowgirl, And I said, that sounds great. And she said, yeah, I should write about that. And I was like, well, if you're sitting on a bench and a butterfly lands on your pen, and that's just interesting and delightful and draws your imagination, and that's the song you write, I would write that song, as opposed to the one that you think you're supposed to write. And she said, oh, that's so funny. A dragonfly landed right next to me. And I was really interested in that. And so she ended up writing a song, not about a dragonfly or about the cowgirl, but about something that was a very personal memory for her. And it was beautifully explored and beautifully done. And I hope that it was that invitation to, I just think that there's that sort of tingly, sparkly, ooh, that's a thing. That's interesting. That is really a useful guide, as opposed to, I want to write a hit like that. Yeah. But ever since Baby Shark was written from an algorithm, we with some great PR around it, obviously you can follow the numbers literally to create certain songs that will have a big lucrative life in the world. It's not how I operate. And it's even not how I operate commercially. Like, the stuff that has really succeeded for me is the stuff that mattered.
Well, you gave your friend some great advice. And I'm hoping then, of course, that you took the cowgirl idea and wrote it yourself.
That's good. Oh, man. Well, Dar, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Once again, the book is How to Write a Song That Matters, meaning a song that matters to you. And you are obviously a skilled songwriter, but obviously a skilled teacher and a great inspiration for people who are trying to figure out how to participate in the magic that is songwriting. So thanks for spending some time with us, and we've really enjoyed it.
Oh, I hope that's the case. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Songcraft, please take a moment right now to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can keep up with us on Instagram at Songcraft Conversations or Facebook at Songcraft Show. To join our team and help support our content, become a Songcraft patron at patreon.com. Visit patreon.com/songcraftshow.
And you can always find us at songcraftshow.com.